This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and it's good to have you with us on this Labor Day. All this hour, we have a special program dedicated to the economy and preparing people today for the labor needs of tomorrow. President Trump ran for office largely on an economic message. He said he would fix the economy, bring back American jobs, and make new trade deals that are more fair for Americans.
We want to build, create, and grow more products in our country using American labor, American goods, and American grit.
Pro-American message from the president there. Well, in his 8 months in office, the markets have soared. Unemployment still hovers right about where President Trump found it, around 4.5%. And several companies have announced big plans to build big factories or plants in the United States. Are you feeling the effect? Is the economy working better for you today?
This is Catherine in Dallas, Texas. I have much more confidence in the way that things are going now. We finally have a businessman who has a clear-eyed focus into the reality of what it takes to make a business and a country run.
Hi, this is Ray from Arlington, Texas. I think that the economy is starting to slow down a bit. I work in luxury sales, and we're really worried about hitting our goals, even for the quarter.
Hi, this is George calling from Salem, Massachusetts. The economy is doing great at the moment. It's really hard to find good employees, so companies are offering higher salaries and better benefits to attract talent. Couldn't be a better time to be in the market for a job.
This is Mike from Plainfield, New Jersey. I feel the economy is doing what it always does, helping the rich get richer and the rest of us is screwed. Corporations are showing record profits, but I haven't seen a raise in 5 years. Where's mine?
Your voices on the state of the American economy, we always want to hear from you. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE to weigh in all this hour.
I feel that people are generally pretty positive.
That's Matt Olson. He's a truck driver who delivers goods to dairy farms all across Wisconsin and Minnesota. Matt sees the economy firsthand as he makes his rounds, and he says that while some small towns seem to be shrinking and it's tough for mom-and-pop stores to survive, he sees signs of a recovering economy nearly everywhere he goes these days, especially in the agriculture sector where he works.
It seems like a lot of feed mills are upgrading their equipment, doing a lot of new construction. A lot of the dairy farms that I go to are also retooling, adding, expanding. A lot of the grain producers, the corn and soybean growers are also kind of seemingly get new equipment despite there being lower commodity prices. I feel that people are generally pretty positive because most people that I run to are fully employed. I don't run into as many people that were like a few years ago were just kind of like piecing different jobs together. Like what I did during recession, my wife and I, we both had like 3 or 4 jobs just to try to make it, you know. And nowadays, it just seems like a lot more people are more gainfully employed and positive and upbeat.
Matt Olson also sees job creation happening right at home, though he'd still like to see more.
A lot of Wisconsin towns, there's a town called Prescott that's to the west of me and the River Falls to the north of me. And basically, they're adding factories. They're adding like, you know, hundreds of jobs. And it's kind of a good, cool thing to see. And then in my town, they added a jail and a school. That's great, but you'd almost like to see, you know, more growth, more jobs. So I like seeing those kinds of things. I looked at our local paper and there's like 4 or 5 foundries hiring. There's a lot of nursing positions open for, you know, like for the baby boomers that are going to be going in nursing homes, you know, the next, you know, 10, 20 years or if they're already there. So I feel that there's a lot of positive things.
Well, Matt, we called up an economist, Harry Holzer, and he might actually agree with you.
The labor market looks quite strong. Productivity is quite weak. Growth is steady, but not spectacular. Wage gains are a little bit ahead of inflation, not as high as we would like. So overall, I would say pretty good, but definitely some weak spots remaining.
Holzer is a professor at the McCourt School of Public Policy at Georgetown and a non-resident senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution. He says the economy is roughly on the same path as it was in 2016, a path that was established during the Obama years.
That's right. I mean, most of the numbers look very similar. The employment growth, the wage growth. You know, the unemployment rate has ticked down a little bit since then, so we're very close to what economists consider to be full employment, even if we're not – maybe we're not right at that, but very close to it. But overall, the trends, the trajectory looks the same as it did last year before the election. The one big change, of course, has been the stock market. The stock market has really boomed under President Trump. The market is anticipating big tax cuts, big – regulation cuts that business would like, but the translation of the stock market into the rest of the real economy is quite limited.
And let's stay on the real economy for a moment, Professor Holzer, because there's this 2% growth rate that we've been stuck at. I say stuck at, that might be pejorative, but politicians all the time look at 2%. They call it anemic. They might be trying to sell their tax cuts or their policies that way. But do you see 2% that way?
It's below where we would like it to be. It's below an historical average. Of course, there's two reasons for it right now. And those two reasons, they're not easy to fix. You know, one reason is that the labor force is not really growing very much because you have a lot of baby boomers retiring. We always knew that was going to be the situation. Not much to do about that. That's been accompanied by prime age people, you know, between 25 and 54, who have also left the labor market. And that's sort of a complicated story. But the labor force isn't growing very rapidly. And productivity growth is quite stagnant right now. Economists have a lot of guesses about productivity growth, but no hard analysis or understanding. And so there's no real buttons you can push on either of those measures to pick growth up. So yes, we would all like it to be higher, but given those circumstances, it is what it is.
So let's talk about President Trump and his strategy on the economy here. We see this mix of high-profile factory announcements, sort of photo op announcements of a factory in Wisconsin or a factory in Indiana, combined with renegotiating trade deals. And then over in Congress, they're hard at work trying to cut taxes and to deregulate, which is pretty standard Republican stuff. What does that mix look like to you?
It is a mixed bag. I do not believe any of that will dramatically raise growth, certainly not within the next year or two. If you take those separate pieces, the factories are really showmanship. I mean, they're very few and far between. Now, if you're in a small or medium-sized town and you land one of those factories, it might be great for your town, might be great for your county, but it's not going to move the numbers at the state level and certainly not at the federal level. And of course, the states have thrown a lot of money at those companies to locate those factories here or to keep them here. And reasonable questions remain about whether it's worth all the money we throw at them. But that's not going to move the national needle at all. Renegotiating trade deals like NAFTA, hard to believe it's going to dramatically change. And if it did, it's more likely to move in a negative direction than a positive. Then you get to the stuff Congress is working on, the taxes and the regulation. Tax cuts are okay. They stimulate the demand side of the economy, but the demand side doesn't really need much stimulation right now. The big question, of course, is how do we pay for those tax cuts? As always, it's a lot easier to cut taxes than to pay for them, because to pay for them, you either have to cut spending or raise somebody else's taxes. Politically, that's difficult. And if you raise deficit spending when the economy is near full employment, it might actually slow growth over time, because it likely will mean higher interest rates, higher inflation, and those things will interfere. And then you get to regulation. And regulation, all else equal, regulation does make the production of goods and services more expensive. But there again, you have to ask the question, why do these regulations exist in the first place? And one of the benefits, so for instance, if you cut regulations on climate, you may get a very small boost to economic growth, but the planet around you will be doing much worse over time. Or if you cut protections for U.S. workers, it may reduce costs and raise growth a little bit, but again, it will hurt workers, especially as they're retiring or when they're forced to work overtime.
So while we're talking about real workers and their real wages, which you say are still stagnant in this country, what would be your prescription if you got into a presidential meeting in the Oval Office or the Council of Economic Advisors and they said, all right, Holzer, give it to us for wages? What would you say?
A lot of people say this. You know, I think the biggest single factor in the long run is improving our education and training system. This is not the usual call for everybody to go to college, certainly not four-year college. But I think there are training opportunities, mostly at community colleges, where people can get certificates or associate degrees in high-demand fields that really would quite dramatically raise their earnings opportunities. And I would like to see those opportunities expanded. There's a range of things I think we could do to expand them and to expand business involvement partnerships with community colleges and in training programs. Another option, of course, is apprenticeship, which the president has embraced, as President Obama did before him. People can differ on some of the details on exactly how each president pushed apprenticeship, but that's a promising approach. And I would add one more thing to that mix. I think what we often call the demand side of the labor market, what employers are doing and the quality of the jobs they create, is very important as well. You know, some employers take what we often call the low road. They turn all their workers into independent contractors. They outsource or offshore as much of the work as they can do. They keep wages as low as possible. There's a different approach towards being competitive, and that's to invest in your workforce, to train them, to create higher paying jobs. And I would like to reward companies that do more of that. I think there should be a national commitment to create better jobs and to reward employers who create internal promotion ladders, do profit sharing, all those things, create good paying jobs, and then create all the training and education programs we need to give workers the skills to fill those jobs. And I think that combination would help a lot. For people who are not going to improve their skills, are going to have low skill jobs, there's some other things we can do to help. We can modestly raise the minimum wage. A lot of states are already doing that. I support a $10 minimum wage at the federal level. I don't support 15, but I think $10 would be a plus. Passing paid family leave and other things like that to benefit lower wage workers and even middle class workers, I think would help as well. So you have a basket of things. No single one of them is going to be a magic bullet, but together, that's a package of policies that I think in the short run and the long run would make some difference.
So, Harry Holzer, as the economy continues to chug along here, look, President Trump is not the first president to cheerlead his version of the economy. He's allowed to do that, and we expect it. But what's the economist's advice for Americans who will watch the next presidential photo op opening a factory in the Midwest, thanks to a great deal that the president has made?
Well, I would tell people to take presidential claims, and I agree with you, all presidents make them, take these presidential claims of credit at least with a grain of salt. And since Donald Trump is a showman and likes to really pump up the credit that goes to him, take it with a lot of salt in his case. Pay careful attention to the economy. Let's note the things are going well, but also let's be cognizant of the stagnant wages, the stagnant productivity, the people out of the labor force, and realize that even though the labor market is tight and even though unemployment is low, there's still a fair amount of work to be done.
Harry Holzer, professor at the McCourt School of Public Policy at Georgetown University. Professor, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we're asking you all this hour on our Labor Day takeaway, how are you feeling about the state of the economy?
This is Julia from Clayton, California. Some things are better, some things are worse. If you think about how much you'd earn with minimum wage and quite a few jobs only pay that, and what it would cost to live on that and have shelter for yourself, and the cost of a college education, health insurance, car insurance, etc., things just don't quite compute, now do they?
Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. More on the economy right after the break. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Zwillick with you on this Labor Day. Remember Matt Olson from the beginning of the show?
I'm from Ellsworth, Wisconsin. I'm a truck driver.
Matt sounded pretty optimistic about the state of the economy. Well, while Matt is seeing some anecdotal signs of recovery, he does still have some concerns.
My only concern is the fact that, like, if there is a dip in the economy, if there is another recession, that a lot of us will be in trouble. I read some statistic that said, like, 68% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. I'm not that far off from being part of that statistic, to be honest.
According to the job hunting site CareerBuilder, 78% of full-time workers say they live paycheck to paycheck, and that's up from 75% last year. So how can we set Americans up to have better jobs and jobs that pay better wages? Well, we've come to think of college as maybe the best way to a high-paying job, and while that might still be true, it's not the only route. Too often, we hear these stories of young people who go to college, leave with massive amounts of debt, and still can't get a job. Allison Cadleck is Senior Vice President at Public Agenda. They're a nonprofit research organization. And she says there's a disconnect between what employers say they want and how well we're training our workforce for the future.
So employers are saying a range of things. They're saying that they are not seeing the technical skills that they need from students. They are also saying that what some call 21st century skills of critical thinking, problem solving, the ability to deal with diverse teams, to think on your feet, to see patterns across narratives, to engage with others from very different backgrounds, to solve problems together, those kinds of critical skills are lacking in college graduates. But they're also saying that they're lacking technical skills as well.
So is this mostly because, Allison Cadleck, that the nature of work has changed and the nature of school hasn't? I mean, I was going down your list in my head as you made it. Critical thinking is something that I think for your college liberal arts educations, lots of people probably get a dose of that. But a lot of the other things on your list that employers are looking for now aren't offered in college and maybe 20 years ago weren't so important in the workforce.
Well, it's interesting. I think it is true that the nature of work has changed, but that's not the only thing that's changed. Students have changed. Everything has changed, except for higher education institutions. Now, there are a number of institutions around this country, and you will see, at least we see, that the most innovative institutions are generally community colleges that are operating with fewer resources than four-year colleges, and then less selective regional four-year campuses and colleges that are serving in the largest numbers those what we call new traditional students. They don't resemble the students of the past. These are not students, for the most part. Traditional students were historically defined as those who would graduate from high school well-prepared to succeed in college with financial support from family. And so everybody, when they use the word college, they picture that student. Well, that student is increasingly in the minority. Most students are working while they go to school. A full third of undergraduates in this country are adults. That's just the beginning.
All right, go on from there. A third of adults are working while they're in school. What else?
By 2018, Bureau of Labor Statistics is saying that 63% of all jobs will require workers who have some post-secondary education, some college education. That is also a departure from the past. The days of being able to graduate from high school and get a good-paying job are gone, absolutely gone. But what we're also seeing is that the shifting demographics in our country are creating a whole new set of populations of students that our colleges and universities have not historically been equipped to serve. So adults make up one-third of the undergraduate population. 70% of undergraduates work. One in five works full-time while going to school. Part-time students make up more than a third of all undergrads, and most of those students are working full-time. There are something like 36 million Americans who have some credits but no credential, and most of those are carrying debt of some kind. So there are – it's all, maybe one other important fact here is that a full 50% of all undergraduates entering college enter with remediation needs. And at community colleges, that's a much higher number.
This suggests a world where work is much more important. People going to college aren't just there for 4 years of campus life. Are universities getting the message? It seems like this has always been kind of the mission of community colleges. Are universities getting the message here?
It depends which sector of universities you're talking about. Flagships, so research institutions, the large public institutions, Big Ten institutions, that's the sector that is probably slowest to change. The sector that is attempting now really to face the new challenges, those are the less selective regional four-year universities. And that's sort of the unacknowledged workhorse of American higher education.
And are those workhorses responding in the way that you describe? Are they preparing students for a new economy where intellectual capital is more important than physical capital and where information technology and critical thinking are paramount?
Not yet. I would say that there are a number of institutions that are universities that are field leaders that are taking this seriously and working very hard to do this kind of work and to innovate on behalf of better outcomes for students consistent with what the labor market today looks like. But the trajectory of higher education in this country and in the West has been such that traditional structures are proving to be remarkably durable. And sort of the model of higher education that we have had for hundreds of years, though it is no longer in step with what the world is like and how who students are today, those institutions are struggling to change basic structures, basic thinking on the part of faculty, staff, and administrators about what it is that they're doing. The age-old confidence that this country has had that education is a path to a better future regardless of accidents of birth or fortune, that is weakening in the minds of Americans as they take on debt, as students graduate and can't find jobs. So there is not the same public confidence in higher education that there has been in the past. And so these institutions will need to respond to that. It is the case that the Berkeleys of the world and the University of Michigan's of the world are probably going to respond slower than other institutions, but they, in some ways, have the luxury to do so because they're not educating, for the most part, the largest numbers of students that are facing the new world.
We're going to take a short break now, but when we come back, we'll have more with Allison Cadleck, Senior Vice President at Public Agenda, the nonprofit research organization. This is The Takeaway. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and we continue now with our conversation with Allison Cadleck, Director of Higher Education and Workforce Programs at Public Agenda, the nonprofit research organization. Before the break, Allison told us about the changing world of work and how students who attend traditional four-year colleges often don't graduate career-ready. So let's pick it up here with the institutions where innovation is taking place.
The places that are innovating, greater attention is being paid to creating structured programs of study that begin with the end in mind. Career exploration is not something that's tacked on. It's a conversation that happens at the beginning of a student's education. This is a movement that is taking off nationally for community colleges called Guided Pathways, but it's also coming for the four-year sector as well, in part because 80% of students who begin at community colleges say that they would like to achieve a bachelor's degree eventually. And so creating clear and coherent programs of study that lead to well-paying jobs is a mental structure about higher education that we haven't seen historically, but it is a turn that many are making.
More of a career track at the earlier stages of education. But Allison Cadleck, what you're describing sounds familiar to me. Don't other countries, I mean, we've heard stories over the years about how, I don't know, in Japan or China, your aptitude is identified very early and you're on a track. Now, maybe that's not something Americans would latch onto, but it's not like we're the first to be figuring this out.
The distinction between education for work and education for life that undergirds the historical notion of VOTEC or vocational training does not hold up in this modern economy. And that is the critical shift, or a critical shift, that needs to be made. Increasingly, for people to navigate this economy and have access to genuine socioeconomic mobility, they are going to need to do both. And the fact is that this is not, for most students, this is not about being tracked, this notion of tracking, which rests on an assumption about a distinction between work, education for work, and education for life. Because most students now are shouldering the burden of paying for college themselves, increasingly they have children of their own to take care of, or they have other relatives that they need to take care of. The idea of why am I doing this is what's driving this, right? So the students today want jobs. They want to know that at the end of this, that the investment that they make, that the time that they take to get an education, to get a credential, is actually going to translate into labor market advancement for them. And so what our colleges and universities, the mental shift and the structural shifts that they need to make, begin with critically interrogating what is intrinsically false about the distinction between education for work and education for life.
The bottom line here seems to be that the days of going to college, figuring it out, declaring in your third year seem to be ending.
Absolutely, because those are not students that graduate in 4 years with manageable debt load. the wandering, the cafeteria model of college, of, you know, wander and find yourself, that speaks to a student population that is shrinking.
And Allison, I can see why the big legacy University of Michigan's have a hard time getting it and maybe don't have a lot of incentive to get it. But if students aren't coming and students can't pay, I would think that the smaller universities would be doing everything they can to get right with what the economy needs.
They are scrambling, they are worried, and they are working on it. And the University of Michigan's of the world, and I'm not picking on the University of Michigan, it's an outstanding institution, but they are serving a slightly different function, and they're depending on different revenue streams to keep themselves going. And they're increasingly modeling themselves after Ivy Leagues in this way, and relying increasingly on private research dollars and other streams of funding. But for those regional four-year colleges and for community colleges, there is widespread recognition now that there is an imperative to change.
Allison Cadleck is Senior Vice President and Director of Higher Education and Workforce Programs at Public Agenda. Allison Cadleck, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Over the past few weeks here at The Takeaway, we've been looking at one segment of the population that's out of school and out of work, but not necessarily out of luck. They're what researchers sometimes call disconnected youth. In 2015, about 1 in 8 youths, nearly 5 million in all, were not in school or working. That's according to this year's county health rankings from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. For our hour-long look at the state of employment in America, here's a conversation I had a few weeks ago with Clive Belfield. He's a professor of economics at Queens College, City of New York, and he co-authored a study in 2012 that measured the economic burden of disconnected youth. We were joined by Kate Kingery, who's Deputy Director of Community Transformation at County Health Rankings and Roadmaps.
I think there are a number of factors that contribute to the disengagement of youth and young adults from school and work. What we've seen in our data set is the communities where we have higher rates of disengagement or disconnection, we've also seen lower rates of educational attainment, higher rates of unemployment, higher rates of children in poverty, higher rates of children in single-parent households, and higher rates of teen birth.
Clive Belfield, is disconnected youth a problem that statistically you can show has gotten worse? And if so, what are the causes?
So we think it has gotten worse mostly because the labor force participation rate of disconnected youth, we like to call them opportunity youth, that labor force participation rate has been going down year on year dramatically since 2000. It used to be about half of teenagers could get a job. Now it's about a third. Now, some of them are going to college, but a lot of them have stopped looking for work or are simply going to college because they can't find work or they've just dropped out of the economic system.
And Clive, from your point of view, is that lousy economy? I mean, is this a case of not as many low-end jobs that young people would want to take at the burger stand or the amusement park, or is it something much deeper and more systemic?
So it's certainly economic forces are driving this. Low-wage work has stayed very low-wage, so working is barely going to get you above the poverty level. School preparation has not improved in the last decade or so, so these students are not well prepared for the labor market. And then there's another factor, which is the Great Recession, which drove a lot of baby boomers back into the labor market. And so the end of the labor market, the retirees, are not retiring as fast, so there aren't as many freed up jobs further down the line. So it's both things are happening at the same time. The poor economy is reducing the incentive to get skills, which is making for fewer productive workers.
Kate Kingery, anytime there is social disengagement, there is crime. There are health problems. There are welfare problems. Can you connect the phenomenon of disconnected youth to many of the other things that we already know about social disengagement?
Well, I think young people make choices based on the opportunities they have available. With this population, we don't see them as drivers of some of the social ills. We see them as having experienced many of the social ills. Anecdotally, we project that among the population that we identify as disconnected or opportunity youth, that there's probably also high rates of homelessness, involvement in the child welfare system, some involvement in the juvenile justice system, early parenting, and likely having grown up in poverty.
You know, Clive, it's one thing to talk about disconnected youth, and 5 million is a staggering number. What kind of adult does a disconnected youth become? I think that's the key question.
I agree. The what we looked at was what are we spending now to try to ameliorate this, to try to make it better right now for the teenagers. But then we realized, what are the consequences when these teenagers and youth become full adults after 25? And that consequence of not being successful in helping opportunity youth, that consequence is enormous. These are students who are repeatedly being affected by this. And so it's not just a one-year deal. The students, opportunity youth, are being subjected to these economic forces every year from age 16 to 24. And when you cumulatively add that up, their adult prospects are significantly diminished.
Well, I want to thank you both for being here. Kate Kingery, Deputy Director of Community Transformation at County Health Rankings and Roadmaps, a collaboration between Robert Wood Johnson and the University of Wisconsin, and also Clive Belfield, Professor in the Department of Economics at Queens College. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. And you just heard about the size of the problem of disconnected youth in America. And our look now takes us to Chicago. Remember, these are 16 to 24-year-olds, both out of school and not working. And in Chicago, there are nearly 60,000 of them. The city is mounting a campaign to reach out to what many there call opportunity youth with a public-private partnership. It's called Thrive Chicago. The idea here is to connect 10,000 of these young adults with education or training, or to put them on a new path. Here to tell us about Chicago's efforts is Brandis Friedman. She covers education with WTTW's Chicago Tonight. Brandis, welcome.
Thank you.
Why is this such a big problem in Chicago?
I think a number of things, Todd. Some folks will point to the education system in the city of Chicago. Everybody knows about Chicago's violence problem, so that contributes. So some of them end up involved in the criminal justice system, but some of the folks that I spoke with who are experts who are working on this problem in Chicago say that actually only about 2,000 of the city's 58,000 disconnected youth are actually criminal justice involved. There are other problems that are contributing. Maybe they are young moms and they have childcare situations and it is hard for them to get to work or get to school. Maybe they are homeless, or maybe they have families who are criminal justice involved. So I think a number of different factors contribute to these young people not being working and not being in school.
And so it sounds like for the people trying to intervene here, and there are lots of interventions, some big ones in Chicago, the real key might be to get into those schools and try to not only keep kids in school, obviously, but sweep them up at a place where they're centralized before they can become disconnected like this.
Absolutely. And I think that is what the city of Chicago is trying to do with this latest effort. They're calling it the 10,000 Reconnected campaign. It comes through an organization called Thrive Chicago. And so the goal is to sort of get together a lot of these organizations that are working on this and to serve as a clearinghouse to find out which organizations are doing what kind of work, how many youth are they serving, how long are they able to help them, and also to get them to share some best practices. And then the intent is to direct them to corporate partners who have agreed to hire these people, these young people, through internships and through apprenticeships, and with the goal of course, getting them back to jobs.
You've been talking to several of the young people around Chicago who've had some of this initial reaction with Thrive Chicago. What'd you find out?
That's right. I met a couple of pretty impressive young men. One of them is Avery Sterling, and we found him at one of the nonprofits that will be working on this campaign. It's called Children's Home and Aid. And, you know, he admits to kind of like, you know, getting in trouble as a younger person, but now he is working as a mentor and a program coordinator helping some younger people. And he kind of explains a little bit about his journey from where, you know, where he started to where he is today.
Hustling. I was selling drugs, trying to make money. I have a four-year-old daughter, so I was a young father, and I needed to make money to provide for my child. And it was a flyer on the ground that said, jobs for ex-offenders, and I picked it up and called the number. I don't like my job. I love my job. I feel like I'm making a difference in my community. I feel like I'm making a difference in my youth lives, and I know how much of a difference was made in my own. We need people to invest in the community. We need community leaders to become community leaders. Like, it takes a village to raise a child. We need that village back.
Brandis, Avery sounds like the kind of young person who was getting into trouble but was just waiting to be shown a door to another place, and he was able to walk through it.
That's right. And it sounds like, you know, we meet a lot of young men like that. And I've heard stories across the city of other folks doing similar work, trying to reach out to young men and young women and help them find some direction. And a lot of them, you know, they need to work. You know, many of them come from low income homes, and so they need jobs. And one of the young men that Avery works with, he's 18 years old. His name is Lewis Blake. He had some problems at home. He found this organization. You know, they're helping him work through some of those problems. But he knows that there are other people like him who just need a little more help.
I was always fighting somebody or something. I had got kicked out of home by my parent, and then I had called the crisis, the hotline. They had a hotline back then, and this was like 2 years ago. So I've been with the company for 2 years. I want to be an engineer. I like math and science, and I like working with my hands. We was talking about updating my resume, adding my new experiences onto my old resume so I can update it. They taught me everything here, and my first resume that I made was here. Like the mentoring program, it should be opened up for, like, we should expand. Like, it should be more, because there's a lot of more people out there that was like me that was probably kicked out, or they might have different situations, might not have no one to turn to. It.
Now, Lewis Blake is 18. He's in an internship. What's he doing now?
So he is working part-time for Children's Home and Aid. It's kind of cute. He actually works with the children of parents, young parents who are there at Children's Home and Aid at one of their local community centers, who are there to get their classes or whatever help they need. But he graduates from high school in June. He says he wants to be an engineer, as you just heard him say. And so I think his intent is to hopefully get into a two-year college, if not a four-year school, once he graduates.
Public-private partnership at Thrive Chicago. The corporations are ponying up some money, and that's great PR for them, to be honest. What's the city doing? What's the state doing?
What the city is doing is they are kind of the main force behind this, because Thrive Chicago was actually incubated in the mayor's office before they moved out to be its own nonprofit. And so it is kind of like the driving effort. But this is a three-year program. So I think they might have to prove that they have got some success. I think we're all probably hopeful that they can show some progress and be able to keep it going, maybe adding more, because as we discussed, you know, we're talking about 58,000 young people today. Will there be more, you know, in a few months, in a few years? So I think they have to keep it going if they're doing it right.
A three-year project for tens of thousands of disconnected youth in Chicago, and a three-year assignment for Brandis Friedman, who's following up on the city's efforts to coordinate disconnected youth and get them connected all across the city. Brandis Friedman, Chicago Tonight correspondent, WTTW. Thanks for talking to me.
My pleasure. Thanks, Todd.
You've been sending us your stories all this hour about the economy. Are you finding it easier or harder to get a job these days?
It seems that the cost of everything has gone up. A gallon of milk often is over $4. The cost of my home utilities has risen. The cost of my cable and internet has gone up. Gas has fluctuated as much as 25 cents within 2 or 3 days. The cost of my employer-sponsored health insurance has gone up, and I feel my dollar is going less and less distance from each paycheck. To counteract that, my take-home pay has now risen a whole $8 in the last year per paycheck. It is barely a pittance in comparison to what everything else costs. I am not sure the metric which is appropriate to measure the strength of the economy. I currently work a full-time white-collar job making around $70,000 per year. I have student loans totaling over $100,000 and can barely afford to pay the interest on those loans. At 37, I feel more uncertainty going into the future than I have ever felt in my adult life. Sean Anderson, Clearwater, Florida.
Call us and weigh in at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Coming up next, former Labor Secretary Robert Reich on whether college is still the best way to climb the economic ladder in America. Stay with us.
Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Zwillick, and we've been talking during this Takeaway Labor Day Hour all about preparing people for work and what qualifications make you employable in America today. For the last several decades, the answer to that question was easy, right? Go to college, get a degree. But earlier this hour, our guest, Allison Cadlick, had this to say.
The age-old confidence that this country has had that education is a path to a better future, regardless of accidents of birth or fortune, that is weakening in the minds of Americans as they take on debt, as students graduate and can't find jobs. So there is not the same public confidence in higher education.
Well, while that notion that college equals success may be weakening, according to a 2011 Pew poll, 57% of Americans say the higher education system in the United States fails to provide students with good value for the money. But the idea is still deeply ingrained in our American psyche, particularly for the middle class. That same Pew poll found that 94% of parents expect their child to attend college. I spoke with former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, who's now a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, about the origins of that story and whether or not it's relevant in the 21st century.
Well, the story is based on reality in the sense that the lifetime wages of people with four-year college degrees are about 50% to 80% higher on average than the lifetime salaries of people with only high school degrees. So it's not mythological. This is reality. But the real issue and the issue we're talking about is whether there should be a second avenue into the middle class. Why is there only one? Why shouldn't we develop? Given that technology is so pervasive in our society, why shouldn't we develop a second path that trains people to be technicians? Now, granted, this is not the be-all and end-all. It's not going to solve all of our problems, but it does take some of the pressure off some young people and some families that really are not going to thrive in pursuit of a four-year college degree.
But that part of the American story and four-year college, Robert Reich, is utterly pervasive, isn't it? I mean, just the term, you know, first in my family to go to college, that's code in America for someone who grew up poor or someone who is the child of recent immigrants, maybe, for getting a leg up, achieving middle class status. It's really ingrained even in our language that we use about Americanness.
Todd, it's deeply ingrained, and I don't want to suggest that it is a false premise. As I said, the lifetime earnings of people with a four-year college degree are substantially higher than the lifetime earnings of people without a four-year college degree. But why should we only try to get more people into colleges rather than look at alternatives? That's really my point. Let's not stop giving people opportunities to attend college. If they want to, if they can get a lot out of it. And I hasten to say, as a college professor, that the sole purpose of a university education is not to get a good job afterwards. You know, it's to provide a lot of ways in which people can live a more fulfilling life and train good citizens. And I think we ought to look at a variety of other ways to provide those goals.
Well, if you take off your economist hat just for a moment and maybe put on a messaging hat, if you like, we're talking about an ingrained narrative, an ingrained story that we tell ourselves. You would like us to have more than one story we tell ourselves so that there's an alternative path here. How do we start to convince Americans and American families and striving American families that four-year college isn't the only way to achieve middle-class status?
Well, we can't even begin to convince anybody unless there really is another way established. And that's why the last year of high school, the first year of post-secondary education, should be a new program, a new system based upon community colleges in which domains of expertise around the mastery of a technical area really are developed with ladders of showing mastery of certain levels of competence. But also, I think we've got to show that there are a lot of great jobs out there. I think that for too long, we've kind of looked down our noses as a society at people who don't have four-year college degrees. Technician work, and let's call it technician work, because this is where the jobs are. These technicians are very skilled. One of the things I did when I was labor secretary years ago was go down to the bottom of a coal mine, and I found that right down there at the very place where the mining was being done were people who had extraordinary technical competence. They were manning machines that were the most complex machines I certainly had ever seen. They needed a great deal of technician capacity. And they really were technicians. Now, that was 20 years ago. Today, it is much more the case. And if you look in hospitals, hospital technicians are very, very much in demand, again, to install, repair, upgrade, and monitor a lot of very complex equipment. The same you find in a lot of offices and really everywhere in the economy. So instead of labeling these jobs as hospital assistant, for example, or retail manager, we really do have to start labeling them as technician jobs to give them a sense of the priority of place they deserve in terms of the skills required.
And it sounds like also there's a long way to go just with parents and with our own sense of what an education means in this country. I mean, I was having this conversation with a friend who told me she was having a conversation with somebody with a young kid who said, yes, I think that not all kids need to go to college. I think that's clear in the economy, but my kid's going to go to college, right? That's what this person said. There's a NIMBYism to that sentiment there, that college is about more than just education. It really ties in with class identity and self-identity, and maybe that needs to change.
Yes, and class, I think, is very much the key there. We associate a four-year college degree with upper middle class and elites in America, and we do that for the simple reason that that, in fact, in post-war America, has been the case. If you're the first one in your family, the first generation in your family to get a college degree, you do have a much better chance of being in the upper middle class, ending up in a place where you can turn around and give your kids opportunities that people in the lower middle class, working class, poor, can't possibly do that. But the suggestion I'm making is not going to happen all at once. Cultural changes are very, very slow. We've got to prove to people that there are advantages to getting a kind of a first-class technician education and that that education is actually out there for people. We know that intuitively. I mean, we know it because of plumbers and electricians, and a few of the building trades have very, very good wages associated with them, but we haven't really absorbed the fact that this new economy, this new high-tech economy, is going to need so many technicians.
Former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich, Professor of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Mr. Secretary, thanks again.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, all this hour on Labor Day, we've been talking about education and wages and jobs. How are you feeling about the economy?
This is Kim from Portland, Oregon. I feel like the economy is pretty much the same as it was last year. It's been on a steady increase, but I am very worried about the policies of the White House, and I worry about a downturn.
Hey, this is Natahe Stoddard calling from Cabot, Vermont. My wages are stagnant for more than a decade, while worker productivity and profits for the already rich owners increase each year.
Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always send your tweets to us at The Takeaway. Thank you so much for listening. Enjoy the rest of your Labor Day. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for America's new credentials on The Takeaway is funded in part by the Joyce Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.